It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Retired Pennsylvania state troopers are among those calling for Governor Tom Wolf to recall the nomination of Acting State Police Commissioner Marcus Brown. Colonel Brown has insisted on wearing a state trooper's uniform to work each day, even though he has never served as a state trooper. For that reason, Brown's critics are saying he shouldn't wear the uniform, that he didn't earn it. Republican leaders at the Capitol are also among those calling for Governor Wolf to recall Brown's nomination. Here with the latest on the controversy is Penn Live reporter Christian Alexanderson, joining us by phone from Harrisburg. Good day, Christian.
Good afternoon, Paul.
You can join the conversation with a question or comment at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm. You can reach us on Twitter at essspgh. Are you a current or former state trooper? Should Acting State Police Commissioner Marcus Brown continue wearing a state trooper's uniform? Is more being made of this controversy than is necessary? 412-246-2002, the number to call. So, Christian Alexanderson of Penn Live, why is Marcus Brown insisting on wearing a state trooper's uniform to work each day?
Good afternoon, Paul. I think the number one reason he's spoken to us about in a couple different interviews was he wears a uniform to honor the people who are serving in the state police and who have served in the state police. And he believes that to lead the men and women of the Pennsylvania State Police effectively, he should be able to wear the uniform.
And he's also said that he's doing it to honor the state troopers, to honor the men and women who serve?
Yes, in a couple different interviews, he's made the point of using the word honor and showing respect towards the troopers that he's going to lead, saying that, you know, to lead the organization, it would make sense for him to wear the uniform.
Now, we've heard at least some retired state troopers speak out and say that they don't like the idea of Marcus Brown wearing the uniform. What do we know about how the current rank and file of state troopers feel? It's hard for them to put their comments out there, or at least to do so and attach a name to it. But what sense have you gotten from your reporting about how they feel about this honor that they may not necessarily have asked to have been bestowed upon them?
Well, the retired state troopers have been pretty vocal, especially on social media online, about their feelings for him deciding to wear the uniform. I had a story out yesterday quoting a couple retired state police officers, and they said he dishonors us by wearing it, that he hadn't earned the right, that he's disrespecting what we had. I think one retired officer said that his decision to wear the uniform was to show his power and authority. So a lot of retired officers are coming out, especially on a couple Facebook pages and Twitter accounts that have popped up specifically to discuss this issue.
Now, while he did not attend the State Police Academy, Mr. Brown is a 25-year law enforcement veteran, and he never did serve as a state trooper. But why is this such an issue? What specifically do these retired state troopers who are speaking out, what is this particular issue that they have with this?
I think to them, more than anything, it seems that they feel it's a matter of disrespect that he hadn't gone through what they had gone through. There's one retired trooper I spoke to that really went in depth about all the different how hard it is to go to the State Police Academy, where you're spending 6 months away from family and friends, and it's almost like boot camp. And that's something that that Marcus Brown hadn't gone through here, so they don't feel it's right that he should be allowed to wear that uniform without having, in their eyes, earned it. Some people have been commenting online on some of my stories that, you know, it's not that big of a deal. Some people are making this way out to be more than it should be. So right now, both sides of the stories are being told a lot, especially in the Penn Live comment section.
So the issue for the retired state troopers is that there's this hardship that you go through, that it's that training to be a state trooper is like going to boot camp, and you are away from family and friends, and you do go through an ordeal, much like a Marine might, say, on Paris Island. Maybe not to that extent, but that there is something about the experience that makes those who go through it feel like they are linked as brothers and sisters.
That's right. I think that's exactly right. Just the hardships that people have to go through, the normal having to study and take all the rigorous requirements of the training that's involved, and that's something that this acting commissioner hasn't gone through in Pennsylvania, so they feel he shouldn't be allowed to wear the uniform. And they specifically point to one person that kind of set the standard for this, which was Frank Noonan. He was the state police commissioner under Governor Tom Corbett, and he came from the FBI, so he was an outsider as well, a quote-unquote outsider. And he decided to wear a suit as opposed to wear the uniform. And a lot of retired and current state troopers online are saying, you know, this is what he should have done. He should have just been wearing suits the entire time. And, you know, that's come up in discussion several times.
And so he continues to wear the uniform. Has Governor Wolf said, you know, we could make this a lot easier on ourselves if you would just relent and wear a suit and tie? Do we know that the governor's made any sort of overtures of that type to Colonel Brown?
No, not publicly. Governor Wolf has been pretty quiet on the situation. He's come out a couple times at different press events and when asked by reporters, and he said that he supports Marcus Brown and that he's sure he's going to get, you know, a good Senate hearing and things like that. But he's never come out publicly and said, you know, I've asked him to wear the suit and he refuses, or he's never said anything along those lines, no.
And is the governor, is there any indication that the governor has maybe reconsidered the nomination that he might be willing to go along with not only the former state troopers, but some of the Republican legislators at the Capitol who are calling for the governor to recall Brown's nomination?
No, so far, publicly at least, he has not come out wavering in his position. The closest thing that might come to any inkling that he might not have support or he might be wavering was that his spokesman, Jeff Sheridan, said to us that the governor was monitoring the situation closely, but that could be read a lot of different ways, so it could mean that he's still supporting and behind him, and it could just mean that, you know, he's keeping a close eye on everything that's going on. So publicly, he still supports him.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Penn Live reporter Christian Alexanderson about the controversy surrounding Acting State Police Commissioner Marcus Brown, who has insisted on wearing a state trooper's uniform to work each day, even though he has never served as a state trooper. He has come under no small amount of criticism for doing so from former state troopers in social media, as well as some Republican legislators who have called on Governor Wolf to recall Mr. Brown's nomination. We have reached out to the Pennsylvania State Troopers Association in preparing for this segment. They thanked us for our invitation, but they declined to comment. But we would like to hear from you, and particularly if you are a former state trooper or perhaps just someone who has served in law enforcement, what are your thoughts about this particular controversy? Is more being made of it than is necessary? Or are you someone who, like other former state troopers, are offended and appalled that Commissioner Brown, Acting Commissioner Brown, is wearing a state trooper uniform to work each day? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Penn Live reporter Christian Alexanderson. We'd like to take our own informal poll here, if you will, on the matter. 412-246-2002, the number to call with a question or comment. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter at ESSPGH. One retired trooper, Christian, who refused to be identified, was outraged enough to put signs up that read, quote, "Marcus Brown didn't earn it," and "Marcus Brown don't wear it," in Hamden Township, where Brown lives. Brown removed those signs. He later apologized for it, but the Hamden police chief said he was investigating whether the removal of the signs constitutes theft. Any word on how this investigation is proceeding?
Well, there's actually been a couple of twists involving the investigation. Penn Live found that the Steve Junkin, who is the police chief for Hamden Township, had several Facebook posts criticizing the acting commissioner for his decision to wear the uniform on Facebook before the sign incident occurred. So once that was discovered, the investigation was actually handed off to David Freed with the Cumberland County District Attorney. So right now it's still being investigated. I know there's more information that came out yesterday that the person who might actually be charged with something was the retired officer who put the signs up, because he did so without permission from the state, or I'm sorry, he didn't have permission from property owners. So that that's kind of taken some twists lately.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation. Let's go to Don in Pittsburgh. Don, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Thank you for taking my call. I was a former policeman, and I know that in every municipality, at every local level, chiefs come in and they wear the uniform, and I've never seen this kind of controversy. And I'm wondering, you know, the acting commissioner did receive a very racist letter in his mailbox, which is unprecedented. And I'm wondering if race might be a factor in the state police coming out opposed to this gentleman. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that that call, Don, and your comment. And Christian, what about the idea that this might be some of this criticism might be motivated by race?
I mean, there's been no comments made publicly that I found. We did see the Philly.com article that came out about the prosecutors investigating the handwritten anonymous letter with the racially offensive language in it. But so far, we haven't seen or heard anything that would definitively say that this people being critical of Marcus Brown has to do with race rather than several different issues and also the uniform issue.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation. Aside from the uniform controversy, Christian, are there other problems folks might have with Brown? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, the Republican leadership, when they sent their letter asking Governor Wolf to recall his nomination for Acting Commissioner Brown, they brought up a number of issues as well. The Pennsylvania State Troopers Association also brought up these issues. One of them has to do with the pension Brown received after he left his Baltimore police commissioner job. He received a $55,000 annual pension after he left to become the chief of the Maryland Transportation Authority Police, and that kind of caused an issue so far. There's also the tax credits that he and his wife received. They owned houses in Maryland and Pennsylvania, and they both received homestead tax credits. So that was another thing. Then the Senate Majority Whip John Gordner brought up when Brown shut down a busy highway in 2014 and had armed officers walking car to car with guns drawn during a manhunt of Interstate 270. There's also Brown's made a couple comments regarding the use of force following the incident in Ferguson.
Yeah, and I want to get into that hold that thought. Let's go to another call from Sarah in Squirrel Hill. Sarah at 412-246-2002. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Very well, thanks. I just wanted to say that I don't understand the reason for the vehemence. I think it sounds like there are a small number of people agitating online, but a matter like this could be settled amicably. And I don't think the vast majority of citizens really care. So it does make me wonder also if there are racist motivations or other angry hidden motivations on the part of just a small number of people here.
Well, Sarah, that is – so you would fall into the camp of those who say that in many ways, as far as you're concerned, this – when it comes to wearing the uniform, it's much ado about nothing.
Yes. As a citizen, I don't know much about the issue, but it doesn't concern me very much. I think it could be worked out civilly if there is a question about whether or not he should wear a uniform or a suit.
Well, it's an interesting point. And Christian, what about that? You know, certainly those, whether they are in the minority or not, who have criticized Mr. Brown have done so vehemently and have been very outspoken about it. And so the question is, are there a number of people or is there a camp, including maybe some legislators, and they are the people who are going to decide whether this nomination is confirmed? Are there people who are saying that while some state troopers, or at least former state troopers, are offended by this, that it really doesn't affect the population at large and therefore is not something that should be heavily considered?
You know, that's not an issue a lot of people have brought up, but something I completely understand and could agree with. You know, most people in Pennsylvania, I would think, wouldn't care what color uniform he wears or if he wears a suit, as long as he had the proper motivation to do the job, as long as he is qualified and hardworking. I think that's what most Pennsylvanians would feel. Now, when it comes to that's the if everything was great in the world scenario. The other is the political realm, which is there are certain people that get to make the decisions, and these are some of the issues they brought up. If the Senate confirmation hearing is going to be eventually scheduled, and I'm sure they're going to be bringing up these issues, and there's going to be some maybe Democratic senators that are going to be saying this isn't that big of an issue, it's a uniform. But to them, still, there's other issues that might be even more important than him wearing a different color uniform.
But again, at the heart of the controversy is the uniform issue. Let's go to Gary listening to us in Johnstown. Gary, good to hear from you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. My comment, I guess, is that this gentleman is not a state policeman. And I always thought it was against the law to impersonate a state policeman.
Well, I don't know about that. I can say, and Christian, you would know about the specifics of this. And Gary, thank you for that call. Christian, in Maryland, Mr. Brown was also in a position of power in the state police, overseeing the state police. He was not an actual trooper, but in that position, he did wear a uniform, did he not? And what was the reaction there?
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, before I began working for the Patriot News, I worked in Maryland at the Carroll County Times, and you know, this wasn't an issue in Maryland. He was passed overwhelmingly in the Senate. I believe it was 45-0 his confirmation hearing under Governor Martin O'Malley, and this just didn't seem to come up.
And to Gary's point, is there an issue of illegality here that not only is it offensive, but that by wearing the uniform, he's actually breaking, if not the law, some sort of a uniform code?
No. There's no way from the district attorney's office, police, state police, anyone with any sort of background in law enforcement has ever come forward and saying that he's impersonating an officer and that's illegal. I think the fact that he holds the position as acting commissioner and is wearing the uniform doesn't break any laws.
Now, I wanted to get back to the point you were making earlier. We were talking about, you know, some of the other problems that people might have with Marcus Brown, and one of those apparently state troopers have been critical of Brown for comments he made as Maryland State Police Superintendent following the shooting of the unarmed teen by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. And I have a quote here from Brown saying that, quote, "There is a place for different pieces of equipment and how personnel should be deployed. The vast majority of civil disobedience in this country is sparked by law enforcement. If there are not restraints in these situations, the actions of law enforcement can further escalate the overall conditions," end quote. That is, I would have to say, not necessarily a comment you would expect to hear from a law enforcement official, particularly somebody who is at the management level. How have some folks reacted to that comment? You said you were in Maryland while Mr. Brown was in that position. How did people react then to what he said?
Well, I'll start off with how it's being reacted here in Pennsylvania. It was brought up during a hearing, I believe it was with the House Appropriations Committee, about his thoughts following the Ferguson incident, and it's kind of related to Second Amendment rights as well. And a lot of retired officers so far are bringing up this issue, as well as Senate leadership, Senate Republican leadership. So it's becoming an issue for some people because during the conversation in which he was quoted, the police executives questioned the use of military equipment in Ferguson. Now, in Maryland, I don't think it made as much of a stink it is, as it is here in Pennsylvania. Maryland's overwhelmingly Democratic, so I could see this being a much bigger issue here than it ever was in Maryland.
So the Second Amendment issue comes into play with – I'm trying to get the connection here. Why was that brought up?
Yeah, exactly. His statement about civil disobedience and law enforcement is also being connected to his working with Governor Martin O'Malley in Maryland's Firearm Safety Act of 2013, and exactly how he was a key figure in making sure those laws were being abided by. And so that's where some of the connection is being made. And during, I believe it was the House Appropriations Committee, he said that he supports the Second Amendment and he doesn't have any plans to institute any gun regulations in Pennsylvania.
A lot of stuff being brought up. It almost sounds like the critics here may be looking at, there is the issue of him, criticizing police for, wearing the armor and the riot gear. And, there's the Second Amendment infringement issue that people are throwing almost anything they think that might be able to stick here just to get rid of the guy?
I mean, it seems like these people are making a very concerted effort. I mean, the State Police Association, or I'm sorry, the State Police Troopers Association and the Republican Senate leadership aren't just listing, well, he took some signs and that's the problem. Or, he wears the uniform and that's the problem. They're bringing up five or six different things to make sure that the governor knows that they're not pleased with his choice and they want him recalled.
In the minute or so we have remaining, what happens next? Where does everything go from here?
So Marcus Brown has already met with the House and Senate Appropriations Committee for their budget hearings. He came out relatively unscathed. After this, he's going to be going through the Senate nominations committee, or nominations process. So the Senate will have their chance to ask him questions on all these different issues. And right now, the Senate Republicans have a 30-20 majority. So Jake Corman, the Senate Majority Leader, has said that there's a distinct possibility that he will not be his nomination will not go through. So right now, we're all looking forward to that hearing and seeing what's going to happen.
Christian Alexanderson is a reporter for Penn Live, and he has been following the case of the acting state police commissioner Marcus Brown, who, among other things, has insisted on wearing a state trooper's uniform, which has created some controversy. Christian Alexanderson, thank you so much for being with us and sharing this information with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.
Coming up, how is the Steel City participating in Earth Hour, and what difference does it make? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This year marks the 9th annual observance of Earth Hour. This Saturday from 8:30 to 9:30 p.m., homes, businesses, and landmarks will demonstrate their commitment to energy conservation and environmental issues by turning their lights out. How is the Steel City participating? We spoke with some local organizations, but first, we'll hear from Lou Leonard, Vice President of Climate Change at the World Wildlife Fund.
Earth Hour is a global event where people can turn out their lights for an hour on Saturday, March 28th at 8:30 p.m. local time, wherever local time is for you. And it's a way of symbolizing your support for action on climate change. It's a little bit like New Year's Eve, where it starts in Australia and moves across the planet with people participating in their local time zone. It's really like a big party. Climate change is something that often can lead us to feel sad or depressed, and this is a way for people to really participate in a celebratory way, connecting with each other and really showing that this is something that we can really handle if we work together. The ultimate goal, well, there's a couple. One is to just get people to see that engaging with the problem of climate change can be easy, it can be fun, and then that becomes a first step where people can then do more after the hour. So you take that first step, then you take the next one when the lights come back on, and that can be just talking more about climate change to break that silence that we have on the issue. It can be switching to green electricity. Most utility companies allow you to do that now. Or it can be, you know, writing to your congressman or to the president and saying we want more action on climate change. So it's really the beginning of a larger set of engagement that people can do to get involved. This is less of an event that's about saving energy per se, and it's more about the sort of symbolism of folks participating, including iconic landmarks, and saying, you know, we are standing in solidarity with each other to face climate change. But the kind of awareness that it builds can result in changes in energy efficiency or other sorts of behaviors. Once you're kind of in the game on fighting climate change, there's so many different ways that you can really participate. You can reduce energy in your own home. You can switch to green energy with your utility. You can walk to work. There's lots of different ways that we can reduce our carbon footprint. And then it's getting involved politically in the process, talking about climate change with your friends and neighbors, writing to your leaders, whether that's at the city level or the state level or federally, and say, we want action on climate change. In 2007, the first year, it was only in Sydney, Australia. It was unclear whether this would even take off and people would want to participate. And then by 2008 and 2009, it had become a global phenomenon with millions of people, thousands of cities, all of these iconic landmarks from the Sydney Opera House to the Bird's Nest in Beijing to the Acropolis, the Eiffel Tower, Times Square, the St. Louis Arch, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge. So it really has become a truly global event where people just like participating. As I said, it's really like a big global party. You know, we need that kind of energy around this issue. People can go to worldwildlife.org/earthhour and learn more about how they can participate and sign up. You can also use the hashtag earthhour to tweet at folks and participate in the Twittersphere.
I'm Mary Whitney, and I'm the Director of University Sustainability at Chatham University. Chatham's been participating in Earth Hour since we were first informed about it, which I think was the first year that they did it, but definitely we've been doing it for a long time. And every year we try to do a little bit more to get people engaged in the process. So when we first started, we turned off just the lights at the chapel. Then we started turning off lights at a few more buildings. And for the last three years, I think, what we've been doing is we've been asking people to sign a pledge that they would also turn off their lights in their own homes because it's a Saturday. Not everybody's here on campus at that time. So we started doing that. And we can actually track how many people sign the pledge every year. It goes up on our intranet, and people can click on the button and sign up. And we also have activities in the residence halls. We ask our eco reps to, you know, like try to encourage people in the residence halls to turn off their lights. And some of them plan parties. The Environmental Living and Learning House always has usually has a little party. They're very, very good about it. And then other halls, depending on, you know, who's in that year and who wants to do something, we do stuff. Chatham University is actually participates in a number of different voluntary sustainability agreements, and those agreements are all sort of overseen by my office and Chatham's Climate Committee. Climate Committee was formed in response to our signing the American College and University President's Climate Commitment, where we basically have committed ourselves as an institution to reducing our carbon footprint to net zero. And that's not just for Eaton Hall campus, that's for all of our campuses. And so the Climate Committee's faculty, staff, and students who are interested in working on these problems. And we have different working groups that are working at different parts of the problem. As you can imagine, it's not something you can fix overnight. So we have
a group working on bicycling support. We have a group working on energy, another group working just on transportation. We have one on communications as we're trying to get the word out to people because, you know, at a university every year you have brand new people who have absolutely no idea when they get here. So we always have to be communicating and talking about it. And the Earth Hour is a very strong symbolic component. It's a certain time. It happens every year, and people do it. And it's not that it so much, you know, reduces electricity use that day. It's the idea that you're saying, yes, this is an idea that matters to us as an institution, and we're participating.
Roland Poole, Associate Director at Wagman Observatory. There's a group of people that are from the organization that are going to be down at the Science Center this weekend. Yeah, the Amateur Astronomers Association of Pittsburgh will have some representatives down at the Science Center. Friday and Saturday nights are our first star parties, and we really don't have any lights on at all for that, except for some dim red lights just to see by. We talk to people when they're here for star parties about light pollution and keeping the lights out of the sky. Well, a lot of the lighting that we have, like when you're driving down the highway and you see billboards and stuff, a lot of times the lights are pointed up into the sky, and that can create a lot of what we call light pollution, which pretty much blocks out the dimmer stuff in the sky, and you end up just seeing the bright stars and the moon, you know. So it's always good to have what they call down lighting. And there are some areas around here that actually have ordinances for public lighting displays, which are pointed down to the ground instead of into the sky. One of which is Richland Township. A lot of the lighting is very wasteful. It wastes energy. You don't really need lights pointing into the sky. You need lights pointing to the ground where people can see it. And the different types of lighting sometimes can be very detrimental. A lot of times you'll see that people put, you know, like the equivalent of a bright street light on their house or garage, 175-watt high-pressure lights. Over time, they use more and more energy to keep the same brightness in the light, so it's very wasteful. If people are talking to me in specific, I'll be talking about light pollution and, you know, keeping the sky as dark as we can so everybody can see the sky, stars, moon, stuff. You don't really see it very well in the city with the light pollution, but every little bit helps, I guess, you know.
Jeanette Walker-Vinsky, Communications Manager at Sustainable Pittsburgh, and this year for Earth Hour, Sustainable Pittsburgh is inviting all of the participants in the Green Workplace Challenge to earn bonus points. And to do that, an organization is invited to participate in Earth Hour by having its workplace dim or turn off their lights. Additionally, if an organization that's participating in the Green Workplace Challenge wants to involve their employees in Earth Hour, they, too, can earn bonus points. For participating in Earth Hour this year, an organization that's participating in the Green Workplace Challenge can earn, at minimum, 2 points, and that is if a workplace decides to participate, they could dim or turn off their lights during this one-hour period, or if their employees participate, the points would vary, and it depends on the size of the organization and the number of or percentage of employees that are actually participating in Earth Hour. And what they would need to do is send an email to Sustainable Pittsburgh after Earth Hour has occurred and let us know that you participated and then take a picture that shows their participation. These bonus points are part of a larger competition called the Green Workplace Challenge, where organizations track and measure their performance in energy, water, waste, and transportation. So by participating in Earth Hour 2015, an organization is earning bonus points that will add on to their current accumulation of points since they began the competition. We have 87 organizations that have signed up to participate in the Green Workplace Challenge, representing communities from southwestern Pennsylvania. For more information, visit gwcpgh.org. So ultimately, organizations that are participating in the Green Workplace Challenge are leaders in the community in embracing more sustainable and green initiatives.
My name is Anna Siefkin, and I'm the Pittsburgh 2030 District Director at the Green Building Alliance. We work year-round to shine a light on the remarkable progress that buildings in downtown and Oakland are making towards very aggressive energy and water reduction goals. But on March 28th, for Earth Hour, more than 100 buildings, like those of the city, the county, BNY Mellon, Highmark, UPMC, and the university community, are all joining our collaborative effort to turn their non-essential lights off. It's a way to show the world the power of the collective, of the people and places in Pittsburgh. Well, we've talked with buildings in many cases on a one-on-one basis, and we've found out what they can do individually. Some of them, they're able to turn off their non-essential lighting around their buildings. Some of them are able to turn off their marquee signage, the letters across the top. Some of them have uplighting, very dramatic uplighting that makes our skyline beautiful for the rest of the year. And for that night, we've asked them to turn off all of those lights. We're very interested in having the entire community come out to not only watch the skyline, to see all of the lights go out, but to also participate in their own homes and to celebrate with friends. It's an opportunity for us to get together. Hopefully the spring is finally here, and we're able to do this as a collection of people in Pittsburgh.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, a preview of this weekend's Farm to Table Food Conference. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
What is the feather duster?
James Haltonen, the curator of the Fort Pitt Blockhouse, uses a rainbow-colored feather duster to sweep up after his messier visitors.
Squirrels.
The blockhouse was built at the tail end of the French and Indian War to bolster the security of Fort Pitt. Located at the confluence of the three rivers, it was a crucial foothold in that protracted empire-building struggle.
Various rodents will come and sit in these gun-loop timbers and have their snacks, which is fine and dandy. I don't really mind that, except that then they lean on the pillows or push on the pillows.
The gun-loops are horizontal wooden slits that perforate the perimeter of the five-sided building. Narrower on the building's exterior than interior, the gun-loops allowed soldiers to take aim at attackers in relative safety. Each night, Haltonen sets black pillows into the gun loops to control drafts and keep out the aforementioned rodents. But when they lean on the pillows from the outside, relaxed, mid-snack...
Set off the alarm, I think, twice now, so...
Ravenous woodland creatures were not the threat Colonel Henry Bouquet envisioned when he ordered five defensive structures, redoubts, to be built at the weakened Fort Pitt between 1763 and 1764. After a year of floods and siege, Bouquet expected a land attack from Native American Indians responding to the broken promises of the French and the British and the growing foreign presence on their land. However, the war was waning, and neither the blockhouse nor Fort Pitt saw armed conflict again. But it did see another kind of siege.
We're below the freeway, so below the Portal Bridge.
Right below the freeway might seem a less than desirable place to keep the city's oldest building, but it's actually a triumph. Joanne Ostergaard is the former president of the Fort Pitt Society of the Daughters of the American Revolution, the organization that has owned and operated the blockhouse since 1894.
It's amazing the building has survived. The winter weather, all that weather, you know, doesn't seem to have affected it. It could burn down without any trouble, and it never has. It was never attacked.
At least in the strictest sense of attacked, that is. By the late 19th century, the aging building was almost swallowed by the dense tenement neighborhood around it, the Point District. Meanwhile, commercial interests salivated over the valuable land. A warehouse syndicate offered to pay $25,000 to relocate the blockhouse, says Haltonen.
That's something that happens to a lot of historic structures around that time, is they're sort of moved away from major urban centers.
But the ladies of the DAR weren't having it.
Obviously, with the Point, it's a very unique geographic location. You can't reproduce that somewhere else. People are always interested to see the real thing in the real spot.
Despite facing down libel, political might, and the likes of Henry Clay Frick, the Fort Pitt Society refused to allow destruction or relocation of the blockhouse. The regent of the DAR at the time, Edith Darlington Ammon, wrote not one, but two bills for the state legislature that promoted historic preservation. It took 4 years and personal lobbying, but in 1907, a bill protecting the blockhouse was signed into law.
women were not doing those kinds of things. They did not even have the right to vote, and they went and advocated to the government.
That's Maureen Mahoney Hill, a consultant who helped organize the 250th celebration of the blockhouse. Ostergaard agreed.
It's amazing that it's still there and still being run by women. I like to think that our group that run the block, you don't say no to them either, because they persevere.
Ostergaard doesn't know what the future holds for the blockhouse, but she hopes the community continues to protect it.
The people living today will be part of history, so why wouldn't you be interested in what the previous people were? We're all going to be history, sooner or later.
For 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh is supported by UPMC. Ask your Pittsburgh history question and find more stories online at wesa.fm/inventingpittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This weekend, the 9th annual Farm to Table Conference is being held at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center, connecting consumers to local food and the farmers who grow it. I'm joined now here in Studio A by Erin Hart. She is Director of Health Benefit Services at American Healthcare Group. Erin Hart, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much.
Also with us is Liz Canchi, who is Director of Wellness Services. Liz, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
What is the main goal of the conference? Talk about why this has been organized and the history of it.
Our company does wellness programs for residential communities, corporations, school districts, and so forth. And so our approach to nutrition is to encourage people to eat real food. So why not just connect them with local farms? And it pretty much satisfies that need, but also there's a lot of other reasons to eat local as well.
And when you say real food, you know, a lot of people might say, well, I eat food all the time and I don't stop to consider whether it's real or not. If it's edible, it's food, right?
Not necessarily. So if you read the box and there's ingredients on there that you can't pronounce, then it's not real food. It's an invention. So our philosophy is like farm to kitchen to table rather than farm to factory to table.
I mean, why is that important, Liz?
I think what happens is that our food has become convenient. So we want something fast. We want something quick. And we have traded in health for the convenience and the cheapness of food. So we want to encourage people to go back to the way that we used to live. So eat fruit and vegetables and eat food that was raised humanely. And local food is an easy answer to that because the small farms can do those kind of things right around us.
So when you say how people used to live, people who are my age used to eat as kids peanut butter sandwiches with this white stuff that you also would spread on there that tasted like
marshmallows.
Yeah,
maybe a little before
had a lot of sugar. So what you're saying is back before they started, everything had tons of chemicals in it.
Correct. Our grandma when we started doing farm to table, she always laughed and said, you know, like you have to teach people how to eat food. You know, it seems so ridiculous, but our culture has shifted to easier, faster, cheaper ways of getting fed and feeding your children.
To the point where we don't know what really is good for us and we're eating things to our detriment.
Exactly. Yeah, our bodies don't know how to process chemicals. They know what fruits and vegetables are. We have a relationship with real food, you know, that goes back millions of years. Our body knows what to do with that. Our body doesn't know what to do with, you know, all of these different sweeteners and additives and genetically modified foods and things like that. So
how is this conference, how is this going to change people's way of thinking?
It connects people to the food sources to make it.
This is Erin, by the way.
Make it a very easy to make it so that they can work it into their daily lives so that it becomes second nature. So if you tried to just eat local right now or just eat real food, you would be challenged to do so. If you go home and look at your pantry and see boxes of food and that's how you've been – or if you just eat out all the time.
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. What difference does that make? I mean, if seafood is flown in from, you know, the East Coast, and we're east but we're not really on the coast like New England is, and that's where the fish comes from. So if that's flown in, if you can't get seafood – here in Pittsburgh and you get it from somewhere else, why is that such a bad thing?
That's not a bad thing. So it's more about eating real than it is about eating local. Pennsylvania's number one industry is agriculture. So for us, it was just sort of like this real simple thing. And people get it. So when we go and do a wellness program at a company, if you go in and tell people, oh, we're going to do like a healthy cooking class, well, then it sounds boring and people don't want to participate. But if you say we have a farm coming in or a chef who's going to cook with a bunch of local ingredients that they got at the farmer's market, it engages people. So a lot of it is about connecting people to wellness without them even realizing that it's wellness. It just sounds fun.
And the American Healthcare Group, and again, our guests are Liz Canchy and Aaron Hart with the with Health Benefit Services, and the American Healthcare Group partners with social services agencies to encourage attendance at the conference. So who do you expect to show up?
We have people from we work with a lot of affordable housing communities. So anybody who's on WIC or food stamps can attend the conference at no charge. We just let them in. We reach out to a lot of social service agencies and WIC offices in the different counties to provide them with like free passes to come. But there's a lot of teachers come. We also do free admission for them, and they can get Act 48 credits. But then just the general population. So anybody can come to the event. It's open to the public. People who are interested in finding these food sources attend. And a lot of people just check it out because their employer buys blocks of tickets for them so that they can come down and experiment. And, you know, it's kind of a hot topic now, so it's really catching on nationally. But when we say farm to table, it's not about going out to eat. It's about getting food and cooking it at home.
So,
and that's our theme this year.
And so part of it is just teaching people how to prepare this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing, too, Liz, that it's about pulling in the people who are – we've talked a lot on this show about food deserts and, mm-hmm. and how a number of people, particularly if you live in certain parts of downtown Pittsburgh, if you mm-hmm. don't have a car – you can't get around. It's a food desert. There's no grocery store there, so there aren't places where you can get fresh ingredients. So I'm assuming that you want to pull these people into the conference, but then what are they going to find out about how to solve that problem when they get there?
Over the years, we've had different programs like our Farmers Market on Wheels program where we connect a farmer to these developments that Aaron had mentioned. The Department of Agriculture gives seniors and people who receive WIC benefits vouchers to farmers markets. So that was one program that we designed to kind of get that done, get the farmer to the buildings. But I think there's a long way to go. Most of those vouchers, in particular through the WIC program, are not redeemed. And so that's why we wanted to partner with WIC and have over the past 8 years to kind of get them there. Farmers also in our area have really developed their way of doing business. And it's a really exciting place to live for local food. And farmers have now developed different ways of delivering their food. So whether it's through a CSA drop-off site or, you know, hopefully what we can do is connect farmers to those food deserts so that they can get added to their route and somehow paid for.
So beyond this conference, people will be exposed to it, and it's basically a one-time thing. But beyond this conference, you're saying there's a way that the connection can be maintained.
Yeah. So, for example, a lot more farmers markets now are accepting food stamps, the SNAP program. And that's really developing over the last couple of years. There's two new food trucks in Pittsburgh that are kicking off this summer, 412 Food Rescue and Fresh Farm Foods. And they'll both be at the conference. So we invite people to come so that they can meet these people and work with them in the future.
Great stuff. Aaron Hart, that's who you just heard, and Liz Canchy with her in Studio A, with me in Studio A. Thank you both for coming in and sharing information about the 9th Annual Farm to Table Conference. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, Bronx Obama will be here. No, he's not the president, but he sure looks and sounds like him. That's tomorrow on the program, and you can go online at our website, WESA.FM, and hear past segments or anything that you might have missed on the program. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.